large number of journalists just don't understand how business works, don't care to know how business works. You need to make money in order to hire people.
Farhan made an effort to explain how business works. Well, how his business works.
We as a company are burning about $250,000 a month right now. We're trying to lower that. The more revenue we bring in, the more our runway gets extended. I want us to be in a point where we've got 12 to 24 months. I think we've built phenomenal products. I think we've built phenomenal publications. We've got over 250,000 subscribers today across the company. Like, we've got something there, but the flip side is like, well, it's not good enough if we're not making enough money.
Beyond Capital Daily being this blossoming flower, it's not outwardly evident what it was that they were basing the replicability of its situation, and that they would be able to both continue scaling that up at the same rate and reproducing that success elsewhere. It's a cool idea, but I mean, it's something you see a lot of in media and business and politics generally is like, is a person, usually a rich guy, who believes that they have an answer that no one else has, or a solution that no one else has tried or figured out so far, and that there is this self-possession, this idea that like there's some unique insight, some really clever idea, this one brilliant thing that if that actually worked, like there wouldn't already be, you know, 100 people trying it or doing it. It's not easy to make money off of media, let alone have it break even. And there's a reason why things are going down. It's not just because they have unions and newsprint.
I think it's really telling the way that journalists themselves don't really try to do these things. We just know too much.
Yeah, there's as I said, like Andrew Wilkinson has like 80 tweets in the past bit, but there's, you know, one of many, 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 I'm going to hone in on from one of these threads. We are guilty of being overly optimistic. If you want to dunk on us for hoping we can hire a lot of journalists and build something great, go for it. Anyone can hope to hire a lot of journalists and build something great. I think we all hope to hire a lot of journalists and build something great. It's the hiring a lot of journalists and building something great. That's where the that's where the prize is. That's where the merit is. It's like,
that's, you know, where it gets, like,
so I'm glad you hope to hire a lot of journalists and build something great. We all do. If it were that easy, a lot of us would have hired a lot of journalists and built something great.
Yeah, I really wonder how much they understood about the industry before they tried this. But I actually sent questions to them about how much they knew, their financials, and ownership, and they did not respond by press time. But I did speak to Aaron Miller, now the CEO of IndieGraph Media, and was a former CEO and founder of The Discourse. In her time with The Discourse, she'd been very public about the various successes and failures of trying to build multiple local bureaus across BC. She said she'd actually met with Andrew before he launched and that he really seemed like he wanted some insight.
I met Andrew initially before he was just kind of getting into the Capital Daily thing. I think he's genuinely wanted and wants to like make a positive impact. Like, I don't think any of that is cynical. I don't think he just came into this thing like to make money or something. Like, obviously the guy knows how to make money, and this isn't the best way to do it. There's just like a ton of different people that he was speaking to at that time trying to understand the journalism space. So like, he talked to a lot of people before he decided like kind of who align with, and he chose to align with Farhan and then also make the investment in Canada Land, which was interesting.
I mean, Farhan was actually the editor-in-chief for a long time of Daily Hive,
formerly known as Van City Buzz.
So he was the editor-in-chief during their expansion. So they started in Vancouver, and then they kind of expanded to a bunch more Canadian cities. And what they did was fun news, what's going on in the city, things to do, restaurants, that kind of thing.
And if you were in Toronto, you could think of it as sort of like BlogTO, but without that like little shred of wit that BlogTO has.
But Farhan's track record is around these fun lifestyle-based sites. So it was interesting that Andrew chose him. I mean, speaking of media transformations and failures, I have my own experience at The Star in 2018. The Toronto Star launched its big Canadian expansion, and they set up bureaus in Halifax, Edmonton, Calgary, other places. Their promises were pretty big. They said they wanted to invest in investigative enterprise news, local audiences. They wanted to make a big impact on the community.
Are you saying that Calgary wasn't thrilled with the Toronto Star brand coming to their town? Like, oh, it's the Toronto Star. Wow, we hit the big time now.
Well, they did disguise their name. In each city, it was called Star, and then whatever city it was in. I was hired at the Star Vancouver, I was hired as a staff reporter, but that didn't last very long. After less than 2 years, they closed the bureau, laid off everyone. Management basically said that they weren't bringing in enough money. Disappointing, to say the least.
And we talk about the Toronto Star a lot here, but it's really famous for, over the years, its big swings that don't pay off. There's always, like, the very least, a grudging respect. It's like, well, at least they tried something. I mean, you know, obviously Star Touch is something that people, a lot of people remember, is that Four Star, the parent company, had owned Harlequin Books for a long time. Then they sold that, and they used a big chunk of the money to launch this tablet product called Star Touch, which would be like this the whole thing designed specifically for tablets to be read every day. But they went big right away. And then it wasn't sustainable because no one wanted this. I mean, it was modeled on what La Presse does in Montreal, and God knows how that works. StarTouch in Toronto, instead of like starting small and then like scaling up, just, you know, starting small to test if there was a market or if people wanted the product, they went big and it was a flop.
Speaking of the Star, recently the Star transformed yet again. In 2020, Paul Rivett and Jordan Butov bought the Star. And in a recent documentary about the whole takeover, it's clear these two have competing visions about the news industry. Butov is about the journalism. He talks a lot about the value of journalism as a public good. But Rivett kind of takes a different approach, one that sees journalism and business as sort of tied together.
The days of the past where you could have a newsroom separate from the bean counters or the newsroom separate from the sales force, or that can't work. It needs to be a modern, profitable business. We should put with the sign Toronto Star, News and Information Technology Company, or something like that.
Can't work.
For a lot of journalists, this kind of thinking is blasphemous. The lines between the business side and the journalism side should never be crossed, as a lot of folks would say. But his statements seem to sort of echo what Farhan has said in the staff meeting tape about journalists not wanting to know about business, about the importance of bringing in revenue.
So when they got the Star, their plan was to do something with e-gaming and gambling, and they had some sort of plan. And then by last fall, when it came out in court documents that the two owners were at each other's throats, it became very clear that whatever plan they had for the Star when they first took it over in mid-2020 had totally fallen apart. That, no, it was not as straightforward or as easy as they had thought or hoped it would be, whatever ideas they had about using these other sources to make revenue. I think they had or have a parcel service now that I guess did not work. And there were competing visions about what to do next. And some, you could call it panicking. And there are just so many examples. People just coming in and thinking, well, if we just hook up journalism with this other business, we can use that money to get this. And, you know, maybe, but if it were that easy, people would have done it already.
So recently, this whole Rivett-Butov debacle kind of was resolved, and the resolution was that Rivett would take over iPolitics and QP Briefing, two smaller political papers. Can you tell me, Jonathan, what's been happening lately with those?
Well, Cherise, we'll talk about this more on Wag the Dog, which is coming out on Wednesday. So iPolitics, that was a long-running Ottawa insider publication subscription online thingy. Torstar bought that a few years ago. QP Briefing, which stands for Queen's Park Briefing, is a paid subscription / paywalled service for like high-level Queen's Park information. It kind of fell apart last week. Let's just say it crumbled with the odd spectacle of, okay, if there were some layoffs, that's bad enough, but then its editor-in-chief and one of its reporters quit, very publicly stating that they were doing so on principle, and we soon learned that it had to do with editorial interference around a story that concerned the Premier of Ontario and his family's relationships with developers.
It's interesting how two ventures who have more business-minded people at their helm are now somewhat flailing after accusations of interference.
Yeah. Yeah.
As journalists, I think we value news for the public good. We value largely news that people count on, you know, in-depth investigative news. We all think those things are super important. But is it sustainable? Is it profitable?
For most of the history of news publishing, of course, the cost of the journalism was propped up by revenues from advertising, including from classified ads, which was an effective model so long as there weren't a whole lot of other places for businesses to advertise.
But now there are. Aaron Miller told me that the problem with these new approaches, where business needs of a venture might get mixed up with editorial, is that she believes that trust is the core of the business.
One of the massive mistakes that our industry has made in terms of our business model is treating the audience as the product rather than as the consumer of a product and like selling their attention, selling your influence with them, etc. And through, you know, advertising and, you know, whatever else, native content or just the old tactic of like, you know, the rich guy owning the press, the old fashioned stuff, you know, not new. And the problem with that is that worked as long as media, news media, was like the only way to reach people, right? But now that that's been completely disrupted and, you know, our attention online is like, you know, we're competing with video games, we're competing with, you know, cat videos, we're competing with YouTube stuff, like my recipe app, like whatever. Like there's just a million different ways that you can be reached now. Like we no longer have a monopoly over people's attention. So as like news producers, we need to shift to thinking about what we're doing as like providing a valuable product, building trust in that product and a brand around it so that folks like trust it and want to support it and like believe in it. And for me, like that's the core of the business.
Aaron also told me about how these failures to produce promised profitable models of journalism make it so much harder for other ventures to raise new capital.
But the thing that's like kind of bigger and more systemic is that like Andrew put $5 million into this company and there's a lot of investors that were watching him. So for that just to go and like completely fail is bad for the investment environment. Like that means that it will be harder for other entrepreneurs to raise capital to try to do digital media stuff because they're like, well, Andrew Wilkins tried this and it didn't work.
BuzzFeed's like a famous recent example where they just got so big and so really good thanks to venture capital. And then when it didn't manage to scale up at the rate that a big tech company does, where the growth is not, I don't know, exponential is not the right word, but it doesn't just skyrocket and kind of stagnates and maybe even dips, you know, the investors kind of panic because like, oh, this is not what usually happens. I mean, in any enterprise, scaling up to that many employees in 2 years is wild. It does happen in tech, but I mean, I don't know what percentage of tech companies actually succeed. And the idea that you can take that logic of extraordinary fast growth that seems to work, at least for some tech companies, and apply it to pretty much any other industry, but certainly journalism, is, well, it's ambitious, especially when they think they have the answer and have kind of held themselves up as like, we got it, we're going to do it. We figured this thing out, and, you know, journalism saved.
That's your Candleland. You can email our regular host, Jesse, at jesse@candleland.com. He reads them all. We're on Twitter, at Candleland. Our website is at candleland.com. This episode was reported by me and Jonathan Goldsby. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our managing editor is Annette Igiofo. I'm your host, Cherise Sutran. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Vas Bednar, Executive Director of McMaster University's Master of Public Policy Program, expert on Canadian business monopolies, and at one time at least, self-described millennial wonk star. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Today on the show, melts and meltdowns. No Name's price freeze has melted, and Loblaws subsequently had a bit of its own public meltdown. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
The no-name price freeze at Loblaws is no more.
As the price freeze on no-name branded groceries also ends.
Today it appears the grocery chain is trolling some unhappy customers.
So as of January 31st, the price freeze on no-name products is over. You may remember, and I know Vass remembers, but listeners may remember that the Loblaw, the overall company, which is singular as opposed to Loblaw's plural, which is the store chain. But anyway, you may remember that Loblaw announced a freeze on no-name products for about 3 months or so.
To help hit the brakes on food inflation, we're freezing the price of all no-name products until January 31st. That's 1,500 essentials locked.
And as the price freeze came to an end, there was news reporting about that, to which people had snarky and or critical tweets, as people do, since tweets tend to be snarky and or critical, especially when talking about monopolistic or oligopolistic retail chains. It prompted a very interesting and uncharacteristic response from Loblaw on Twitter, and that took the form of about 26 tweets over a stretch of 9 hours from 10.09 a.m. to 7.08 p.m. on the same day, January 31st, which was pretty weird because, like, that account had tweeted an average of 10 times per month in 2022. So this was really out of character. And all the tweets were really weird and snarky. And this is an account that is mostly just taking customer service, things like, oh, hi, we're sorry to hear about your disappointing experience. Please DM us and we'll look more into it. Instead, these were various responses like, we took a stand on the price freeze because we knew that the price of food was a huge concern for many Canadians. We're not done cutting grocery bills. This year, the average Canadian will save thousands of dollars if they pick no names over the national brands. Or, we may be the face of food inflation, but we are not the cause. The staggering increase of costs throughout the food supply chain end up on our shelves, leading to higher prices. We can say with confidence our profits aren't the reason for food inflation. Our grocery margins are flat. Suppliers' costs to us continue to climb, pushing prices higher. And this wasn't like messaging pushed out as broad pronouncements. These were replies to people who mostly just mentioned Loblaws in a tweet. Loblaws and the word prices, or sometimes some combination of the words no name, profits, and or Galen Weston, who's the head of the company. Vass, I imagine you saw this. What did you make of this eruption when it came to your attention?
I was very intrigued. I think the tweet I saw the most kind of chatter about, kind of cascading, was the one about, you know, on a $100 bill, we make about $4 of profits. And I think chatting about the profit element is probably where a lot of people's minds are at. There's been a loss of trust from long ago with Loblaw. Mm-hmm. Of course, people bring up bread price fixing. The Bureau's exploration of price fixing is still ongoing. But don't forget how the major grocers all conveniently ended hero pay around the same time. So this kind of skepticism and being kind of adversarial with the company is not that new, but it's been heightened, of course, when they're posting record profits and people are seeing the price of food going up. People are looking for radical transparency, not being scolded randomly when you haven't even tagged someone. I think we should view Twitter as more of an outlet, not a place we're going to resolve what may be very valid misconceptions.
Yeah, scolding is definitely the right word for it. And yeah, the over 24 tweets, only about a third were replying to people who had like directly or indirectly engaged with them. In most cases, they seem to be sort of like seeking out comments to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a friend of mine, and I only realized this like today, he sort of started to test it. Michael Wheeler, he happens to be a digital theater practitioner, and this, I guess, is a form of digital theater. He said, like, I have to test this strategy to see if it's the job of a human, and just tweeted out, very disappointed that Loblaws has dropped the price freeze on no-name items. I thought they cared about Canadians. And sure enough, 14 minutes later, he heard back, Michael, we know food prices continue to be top of mind for Canadians, etc.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's not new that people are angry or annoyed at Loblaws. This Hour's 22 Minutes has been making fun of them recently.
Hi, Canada. It's me, Loblaw's CEO, Galen Weston.
I hate you, Galen Weston.
And I've heard you loud and clear. You hate my dumb little guts. All because I've been gouging you on groceries and lining my pockets while the country burns.
I hope you rot in hell, Galen Weston.
Well, I'm here to say I'm sorry.
Is he being serious?
Yes.
But there's this hour, 22 minutes, similar things going back to the last recession, 2009 as well.
As God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again. Don't worry, that's just a quote. I've never been hungry. I'm one of the richest men in the country. Thanks, Dad.
They've long been a punchline and people have long been angry. Why all of a sudden last week do you suspect that something blew and they decided, we're going to correct the record? We're going to go out of our way to correct the record with his randos.
Correcting the record with randos. You know, there have been different kind of parliamentary committees starting to engage with the grocers even more. So there's kind of this sustained political scrutiny that could be inviting this. If they truly are the face of inflation to Canadians, then the ability to kind of be a trusted knowledge broker doesn't quite seem to be there. But let's be real. Loblaw is not just a grocer, and they also have some market power with certain supply chains as well. So in terms of why now and what at this moment, perhaps they had an explicit strategy to not engage before.
One thing I did notice, and I don't know exactly what it signifies, is that the metadata in the tweet suggests that it was, in fact, someone else suddenly tweeting from some different platform. The tweets from that account, Loblaw Co., are usually from Salesforce Social Studio, which is like a, you know, general marketing customer service management thing, whereas all of a sudden most of the tweets that day were from TweetDeck, which definitely suggests it was like, okay, someone else hopped on there.
Maybe they were really starting to see the reputational risk of not trying to chime in and help people understand what's going on. But in terms of actually understanding what's going on, I think people want radical price transparency. That attempt with the $4 on the $100, why? You know, people are asking really important questions. Why? Why do my eggs cost this much? Why does this bag of dried beans cost this much? So maybe if they can actually do more to disclose and bring more transparency, that's the only way that they're going to build trust. We do have the Competition Bureau doing a study, conducting a study right now to study competition in Canada's grocery sector. But because the Competition Bureau does not yet have the ability to conduct market studies, they cannot compel the right documents from grocers to really understand. And we know that Loblaw conflates their grocery earnings. They lump them in with cosmetics and pharmacy. So if we actually want to use our full policy toolkit, I would say and have said we should have a royal inquiry into inflation and the cost of basic goods so we can actually, and we've done this kind of in the past, we have historic precedent in Canada, so we can either, what's the cliche, put it to bed for Canadians that these price increases are justified, or where are people truly capitalizing and hiding a price increase under the guise of inflation?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question, I feel like, and that is the thing that, you know, the Toronto Star explored in detail last year, is the question of gross margins and also net earnings, about the fact that not just have the profits increase, but the profits relative to the costs have increased. Like, the actual degree of profits seems to have firmly increased. And yes, they've sort of tried to, it's not necessarily obfuscation, but they've tried to explain there's certain segments that, like cosmetics, that disproportionately represent this or that. But I guess, just looking at, I mean, I'm sure you've looked at their earnings reports, like, it does seem like the degree of profit has gone up beyond what it would be if it were just matching inflation, right?
I haven't gotten deep in the creep on all of their earnings reports. But again, intuitively to Canadians, this firm is having trouble reconciling these dual narratives of historic record profits with the price increases that people are seeing. So they're trying to justify and rationalize these price increases while telling a different story, and that story is more to shareholders, which says we are doing so awesome, more awesome than ever before. Could that largely be due to the fact that many more people have been sick consistently than ever before and are cleaning out kind of Shoppers Drug Mart and, I don't know, trying to look good on Zoom? Sure, that could be a component, but they have fumbled in terms of rationalizing that back to people.
One of the fun things you said, like, they're trying to sort of try this dual narrative of, like, we really care about prices and also we're making all ton of money, which they have to offer those to different audiences. And it's been kind of fun trying to see them thread that needle in their earnings calls.
Mm.
For those who don't know, earnings calls are like large publicly listed companies. When they release their quarterly reports, they'll do like a presentation, usually over some shared phone system where media can listen, but usually analysts from financial institutions ask questions. And so they're trying to basically talk up the company. And so like last spring, this is quoted in Marco Chenovitz's Star Story, they were kind of seemed sort of blasé to inflation. Like, we don't really pay attention to that. We just try to match our competitors' prices. But by last fall, Galen Weston was delivering messages akin to sort of what you're seeing on Twitter now, where going out of their way to talk about how much they care about Canadians.
As you know, we took the unprecedented step of freezing prices on Canada's second largest brand, No Name, locking down 1,500 items. The response has been overwhelmingly positive, leading to even stronger control brand sales outperformance since the announcement. We also added an incremental points days event in the quarter, offering exceptional points-based discounts across our entire business.
While at the same time not really offering much in the way of what they're doing, like how they're actually addressing it. They said, well, we added an extra points day in the fall.
Mm.
And they said, well, we had the no-name price freeze, which has actually been great for sales of no-name products.
Yeah.
That is super interesting to think about how they talk internally and how that messaging, now that they know that media is paying much closer attention to their earnings calls, or at least people other than maybe traditional business and markets reporters are paying attention to their earnings calls, they've started to try to include that messaging.
Mm-hmm. And maybe people didn't realize when that price freeze on their private label brand, you know, the no-name brand was ending. And perhaps that was part of the impetus for starting to respond to people, because they would notice if they had memorized or been drawn to consistently that brand that there were price changes. So perhaps that was the prompt for some of this. I'll call it chirping, because that's really kind of what it seems like.
Yeah, Sylvain Charlebois, the sort of controversial food professor, he had a reasonable question on Twitter about, like, why does Loblaws attract so much of this public scorn and anger, whereas, you know, Metro is at least as bad. I mean, like, why Loblaws as opposed to, you know, Metro, he didn't say Sobeys, but that's the other company that controls most of the grocery market in Canada. And Chris Selly of The Post had this observation, maybe because they don't put Hamish Q. Metro III on TV for everyone to hate. And this is this really interesting question of, like, the company that for a long time has basically foregrounded its billionaire owner as its mascot.
Hi, I'm Galen Weston with another small way to help the planet.
PC is about quality, innovation, and giving you more ways to save.
I know food prices are top of mind these days. They just keep going up.
Do you see shifting attitudes towards people's tolerance for wealth or extreme concentration of wealth?
It's a big question. I think we see it with Roger Shaw and the Rogers family, you know, and this connects to, I feel like I'm doing a Canada Land ad, but it does connect two of your major series, the one on Monopoly, but also the one on dynasties and family wealth and how that contributes to income inequality. So I think It's not just when the CEO is the broker and face, but when Galen Weston sort of pantomimes as an everyman or is a little bit paternalistic to us, talking about the care that they're taking, you know, during the pandemic in their stores.
Every day now, it feels like a new part of our lives is impacted by COVID-19. Our stores are no different. So I wanted to share some things you're going to see changing in our supermarkets and pharmacies.
And it's like you and the other major grocery stores all around the same time stopped hero pay. Like, how is that not collusive? You know, since then, to Canada's credit, Canada has made it illegal to fix wages. It was actually permissible before. So we did slightly update our competition law. They've been caught kind of, I would say, doing shady things in the past. So I think when you start to connect that in terms of the history of how the firm has behaved and how it treats Canadians and discerning shoppers, I think it's okay for people to be annoyed.
Shortcuts this week. Thanks for joining me, Vass.
Thanks for having me.
We are on Twitter at Canada Land. I am still regrettably on Twitter at Goldsby and also kind of on Mastodon. You can also email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. Where can people find you, Vass?
I'm on Twitter at VassB, and I limit my social media to that and LinkedIn.
Ah, very smart. This episode is produced by Aviva Lasard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofo. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.